This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiz Wahib in Washington. Here is what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
And the interlinked climate, biodiversity and pollution crisis require urgent action from the whole of society. People's choices matter.
That was UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres on a new report about the climate and pollution threats to the world. Details coming up also. Sudan recalls its ambassador in Ethiopia for consultation. And Niger will be conducting a runoff election on Sunday between two political heavyweights. These stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. Roads were closed and the international airport shut down after gunfire broke out in the Somali capital Mogadishu early Monday as security forces cut off a planned opposition protest amid disputes over delayed elections. With the term of President Mahamadou Abdullahi Farmajo expiring February 8th and creating a growing crisis, politicians and analysts warn that tensions and clashes could degenerate into full-out conflict. VOA's Somali service reported that Turkish-trained Somali military police cordoned off roads leading to the demonstration site before a brief gunfight broke out with guards of the opposition candidates. It was unclear if there were casualties. Former Prime Minister Hassan Ali Kahiri, who is a main candidate in upcoming presidential elections, said police fired live bullets into a crowd of unarmed protesters. Other reports said police fired in the air. The international community, including the U.S., called for calm and restraint by all parties involved. Sudan has summoned its envoy to Ethiopia, home for consultations amid a growing border dispute that has seen a military buildup in recent weeks. Sudan's foreign ministry has warned Ethiopia to pull back troops it said were sent across their border or face the consequences of its aggression. Ethiopia, for its part, said it would only negotiate if Sudan pulled its troops from the areas Addis Ababa says it took from Ethiopia. The dispute dates back more than a century when Sudan's former colonial ruler, Great Britain, set the border with Ethiopia. Addis Ababa has long contended that the disputed area, Al-Fashqa, should belong to Ethiopia. Instead, for decades, there has been essentially a soft border, allowing farmers from Ethiopia to remain on the land they have long worked on the Sudan side. Kadir Haroun, a former Sudanese ambassador to the U.S., spoke to VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shalawi about the dispute.
Interpretation of a strongly worded statement issued by the Sudanese foreign minister stems, in my opinion, for frustration due to the fact that the Sudan-Ethiopia borders are among the old demarked borders in Africa. It was demarked upon the request of the Ethiopian Emperor Menelik to the representative of United Kingdom of Great Britain in Ethiopia in 1902, as Sudan at that time was a British colony. The agreement was concluded and signed. Sudan, which became independent only in 1956, Sudan accepted the inherited border, respecting the Organization of African Unity of 1963, of respecting borders inherited from the colonial rule. So I think this is the source of frustration by the Sudanese authorities that this issue has been concluded long ago and many times before that. So this is, in my opinion, tell about this harshly worded statement from the Ministry of Foreign Affairs in Sudan.
But Sudan has vowed to regain control of similar other enclaves in the area and invited Addis Ababa to negotiate the placement of border signs according to a 1902 agreement confirmed in 1972. What erupted the problem now?
One of the root causes of similar situation in Africa, in particular, ordinary people do not recognize these political barriers and they used to mingle freely across. But there is a long history of this trespassing by the Ethiopian into this area in particular. It happened before in 1947. Emperor Haile Selassie of Ethiopia, he accepted the legitimacy of the agreement of 1902. The problem surfaced again in 1966 and 1967 and 1968, which led to discussion again on the issue and settled again based on that 1902 treaty. The final settlement was reached, as you said, in July 1972, where the two triangles of Fashoda north and south of the River State agreed upon as part and parcel of the Republic of the Sudan. The independence of Eritrea from Ethiopia in 1993 and South Sudan from Sudan in 2011 has not changed the situation on the ground as the two new countries laid beyond this territory. In 2001, a joint committee toured the border area and renewed demarcation all signs and decided to lay them every 2 miles instead of every 12 miles. They convened again in 2011 to apply what was agreed upon earlier. The problem again, you know, in 1995, the Sudanese army deployed some other places and evacuated part of these enclaves, which you mentioned. So this is allowed influx of new Ethiopian into the area. Fashaga, this is the name of the area, as the border was demarked. Sudan could have raised the issue, claiming other areas in Ethiopia, such as Beni Shengol, based on the fact that Sudan was a colony and should not abide by the colonial rule that gave it to Ethiopia. But the African founding fathers were wise enough to lay a principle when they established the Organization of African Union, whereby the borders inherited by the colonial rule should remain intact, or otherwise Pandora boxes would be open to set the entire continent in flames.
That was Kadir Haroun, a former Sudanese ambassador to the United States, speaking with my colleague Mohammed Al-Shenawi. Suspected Islamists have killed at least 18 people in northern Burkina Faso and 9 people in central Mali. Burkina Faso, one of the world's poorest countries, is struggling with a jihadist insurgency that began in neighboring Mali in 2012 and spread into its territory in 2015. According to Reuters, these attacks by militants with links to Al-Qaeda and Islamic State are common in the two West African countries, despite the presence of 15,000 UN peacekeepers and 5,100 French troops. This week, Chad announced it would deploy 1,200 troops to the area to help out France's counter-terrorism force as leaders of the Sahel countries and their allies met to assess the security situation in the region. Since the start of the year, more than 150 civilians have been killed in Mali, Burkina Faso, and Niger, the epicenters of the Sahel attacks. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres is urging governments and the international community to come together to address worsening climate and pollution crisis to prevent further pandemics. From Nairobi, VOA's Ruben Chama reports.
After unveiling a UN report by the UN Environment Programme, UNEP, Guterres warned that the world faces a serious threat.
And the interlinked climate, biodiversity and pollution crises require urgent action from the whole of society. People's choices matter. For example, some two-thirds of global CO2 emissions are directly or indirectly linked to households. And this new report brings together the key insights of all the most important environmental assessments of recent years. And it uses those insights to chart a path towards a sustainable future.
The report, Making Peace with Nature, lays out the gravity of the three environmental crises: climate, biodiversity, and pollution, by drawing on global assessments, including those from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change and new findings on the emergence of zoonotic diseases such as COVID-19. The UN chief also welcomed US President Joe Biden's decision to rejoin the global conversation on climate change.
The fact that the United States is joining the Paris Agreement is in itself very important. A number of measures were already taken by the US administration in different aspects related to energy and other climate-related issues. It was also announced that the U.S. would restart their financial support to the developing world in regard to climate change.
The report, released ahead of next week's UN Environment Assembly, assesses the links between multiple environmental and development challenges. Amid a wave of investment to re-energize economies hit by COVID-19 pandemic, the report presents a strong case for why and how urgent action should be taken to protect and restore the planet and its climate. Inge Andersen is the executive director of UNEP.
We have to use this report as a guide to embark on a sustainable recovery from the pandemic, to make strong and meaningful commitments at the summits, to follow up with immediate action, because there are no backup plans for a planet in emergency, to redesign our economies and to ensure a just transition for all.
The authors point out that ending environmental decline in all its forms is essential to advancing many of the sustainable development goals, in particular poverty alleviation, food and water security, and good health for all. An example is how intensifying agriculture and fishing in sustainable ways, allied with changes in diets and lower food waste, can help end global hunger and poverty and improve nutrition and health while sparing more land and ocean for future. Ruben Chama, VOA News, Nairobi.
While the world focuses on fighting and surviving COVID-19, the Ebola virus, which killed thousands in West Africa in 2014-16 and continues to reappear, is back in two different countries. On February the 7th, the Democratic Republic of Congo confirmed 4 cases of the virus, and 5 Guineans have died over the past week, prompting Guinea's government to declare a pandemic. But this time, there's an effective Ebola vaccine that so far has helped contain outbreaks. To find out more about the development of the Ebola vaccine, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with Tiffany Harris. She is professor of epidemiology at Columbia University Medical Center in New York, and Director of Strategic Information at the ICAP Center of Columbia University.
Ebola wasn't a new disease in 2014, 2015. The scales of the outbreaks were much larger, but there were scientists at various labs across the globe working for the last several decades. But as with many diseases where there are not large number of cases, there was challenges in getting funding and moving ahead.
But when the Ebola epidemic really hit, they already had a field-tested Ebola virus vaccine to try out, is the point.
Yes. The one that they tried in Guinea seemed to prove effective. That trial showed around 75% effectiveness.
And that trial-tested vaccine served a dual purpose during the 2014-2015 outbreak, didn't it?
Right. They were able to do a study sort of in the midst of the outbreak as a way to try to study this vaccine, but also to control the outbreak.
How was it used?
They vaccinated rings around people identified as cases, and they vaccinated this initial ring of contacts of those cases and then the contacts of those contacts.
And to scientifically prove efficacy?
They randomized the clusters to either immediate vaccination or delayed vaccination. And those in the delayed vaccination group got vaccinated 21 days later.
So one might ask, why didn't they just vaccinate the whole country at that point?
There is a supply issue. We're seeing that now with COVID. They also needed to study it. So if you just give everyone the vaccine, if the disease goes away, you don't know, was it because of your vaccine? Or maybe it just would have gone away for other reasons. And so you need to do some kind of trial where you have your intervention group and your control group.
So the Ebola vaccine was 75% effective then. How effective is the vaccine that we have nowadays?
There's varying data, but it seems that maybe the effectiveness is closer to 100%. It's an effective vaccine. One of the things the WHO is studying, though, is people who got vaccinated as part of previous outbreaks, are they now cases in the new outbreak? They need to understand whether a booster might be needed or revaccination if there's another outbreak or if you get lifelong protection. But right now, with the Ebola vaccine, the plan is to do this targeted vaccine approach in response to outbreaks.
Okay, so it won't be an automatic vaccination for all children and travelers, like the way it is for yellow fever vaccines, for example.
That's not the plan right now. Yellow fever vaccine, for example, for travelers, is only required for travel to certain countries where there's yellow fever. And the thing that's different also is yellow fever is a vector-borne disease spread by mosquitoes, and it's exposure to a geographic area, whereas Ebola is only spread from person to person. And so you can use this ring approach where you really just focus on vaccinating those who had potential exposure to a case. Sometimes what you can do also is vaccinate a specific geographic area, maybe like a whole village, if it's very difficult to identify specific people as contact.
But now that they have nearly 100% effectiveness, why do they continue to vaccinate people in these concentric rings emanating from positive cases? At this point, why not just go the whole way and vaccinate everyone?
Good question, and the answer is multifold. Vaccines have expiration dates, and so with Ebola, we haven't seen widespread Ebola outbreak across the whole globe. So there's not really the impetus to mass manufacture vaccines. The WHO is working to create a stockpile that can be used for an outbreak, but it's not like COVID, which has swept the globe, or flu, which is seen globally, measles, mumps, things along those lines. And it is a resource issue at the end of the day, right? So if you're spending money manufacturing vaccines and getting into the arms of every person in a given country, that's money that's not being spent on something else that's way more common, like measles vaccine or even other non-health related issues.
Tiffany Harris is a professor of epidemiology at the Columbia University Medical Center in New York and directs the Office of Strategic Information at the university's ICAP Center. Dr. Harris spoke with VOA's Adam Phillips in New York. Niger's runoff presidential election Sunday is a clash between political heavyweights. Mohamed Bazoum is the anointed successor of outgoing president Mahamadou Issoufou, while Mohamed Ousmane became the country's first democratically elected president in 1993, only to be toppled in a coup 3 years later. Both candidates are stalwarts of Niger's political scene, but immense security challenges await whoever emerges as victor. A brutal jihadist insurgency is intensifying in the country's west, while Islamist militants from the Nigerian movement Boko Haram wage incessant attacks in the southwest. Hundreds of troops have been killed and hundreds of thousands of people have fled their homes. A senior defense ministry official told the French news agency AFP that thousands of security forces have been deployed to protect voting day on Sunday, and Niger's borders will be closed for 24 hours. The Zimbabwe government is looking at tightening its COVID-19 lockdown rules in light of revelations that the highly infectious variant, which recently emerged in neighboring South Africa, is dominating new infections in the country. Arigando gives us more on the issue.
The Minister of Health and Childcare says 61% of new COVID-19 infections in the country are due to the highly infectious variant first reported in neighboring South Africa. The government is mooting increasing restrictions on citizens in a bid to curb the spread of the deadly disease. Meanwhile, Zimbabwe received a donation of 200,000 of the Chinese Sinopharm vaccine early this week. But there are concerns among Zimbabweans on social media, with some saying that the Chinese drug has not been approved by the World Health Organization. Sinopharm vaccine comes with a host of restrictions. It should not be administered to people with allergies to vaccines, foods, acute respiratory diseases, cardiovascular disease, eczema, HIV, and other conditions. Pregnant and lactating women are also excluded. The Zimbabwe Lawyers for Human Rights has written a letter to the Ministry of Health and Childcare highlighting its concern that Sinopharm is yet to undergo the final stage of testing before it is used for the greater population. Morocco and Egypt also have acquired the Chinese drug. Observers say public concerns are justified after Acting Secretary for Health Robert Mjigirandima said the government will be conducting clinical trials while vaccinating the target group to test its efficacy against the South African variant. Efi Ncube, a sociopolitical commentator, says the risks are unknown.
People have every reason to doubt its efficacy, to doubt its effectiveness against the disease for which it has been manufactured for. So we are going to see a lot of resistance to taking the vaccine from China because the World Health Organization has not yet approved it.
The armed forces, health personnel and immigration officials are in the first priority group. Teachers and lecturers are in the second priority group and some are expressing reservations. The Progressive Teachers Union of Zimbabwe, Takavafira Joe, weighs in.
We are skeptical about the vaccine from China. It seems this vaccine is still at an experimental stage. So teachers have been very clear that what they want to see first is that the presidium must be publicly tested using that vaccine in order to boost public confidence in the vaccine. But we've also taken a decision as a collective of teacher unions in Zimbabwe today that whenever the vaccine will be brought to teachers, it must be on the basis of willingness and not as a mandate.
People's movements already are heavily restricted due to COVID-19.
So it's very difficult to see what else the government can do by way of restrictions to curb the South African variant. The most important thing is to increase public awareness and education to ensure that people do not do those things that will further spread the virus.
Observers such as Ncube say that the vaccine rollout typifies failure in public health communication by the government. Reporting for VOA, this is Adigondo in Bulawayo, Zimbabwe.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yeheyes Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbili Abaro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.
Well, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and Sundays at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
The Voice of America's Global News Program, International Edition, brings you an in-depth look at the biggest news stories of the day. Nobody covers the world more comprehensively than VOA. Our correspondents gather the news and the views of the most seasoned experts on international issues. Tune in Monday through Friday at 3:30 and 1705 UTC on The Voice of America.
V VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bobo music to hip life, bonga flavor to soukous, Afrobeat to ndombolo and makossa to kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after the